Okay, so tonight's topic, last week we didn't have a shiur, but tonight we're carrying on. We started with the topic of Tfilat Kelim 2 weeks ago, and we'll carry on with that tonight, the second one in the series. Very relevant and practical topic always, but especially now. A lot of people have been asking, what do we do now before Pesach? People are buying a lot of new pots and pans and dishes and all the time. Now people are buying new glasses and cutlery and whatever it is. Normally you would go and you would take it to the mikveh. Now that most of the mikvahs are closed, social distancing, and it's not so practical and so safe to go to the mikveh to take the kelim there, what do we do? Is there advice? How do we need to do anything? How do we circumvent this, so to speak? So we'll get to that as well. I think whereas the last year we focused more on the conditions that are necessary in terms of tefillah. We spoke about what the kli is made of, we spoke about what it's used for, we spoke about who owns it. So tonight we'll move on, we'll talk briefly about the actual tefillah itself, a couple of the conditions, how that is done, and then we'll talk about a few complicated situations where it may not be so easy, may not be so practical to tovel the kli, whether that's because we have electric utensils, whether that's because you might be in a situation where it's not your kelim, you might be visiting somewhere, you might be in a restaurant or a hotel, where whatever reason they haven't done the tefillah. And finally, of course, our current situation where the mikvahs are just closed and practically speaking, there is no way to do it. What do we do about that? So let's have a look at the book. I'll put it up on screen. Yeah, you should all be able to see it now. You see the heading of there, the laws of tefillat kelim number 2. So first of all, just in terms of the tefillah, where it has to be done, it has to be done in a mikveh of 40 se'ah, 40 se'ah, that is the minimum amount for any mikveh, whether that's for kelim or the havdil, you know, a person who's going to the mikveh, that's the minimum amount of water that it has to contain. And the point is that it's rainwater that was, natural, not water that comes from the tap. This can be done in a spring as well, it can be done in a river or any sort of natural water source where it's gathered, as long as that minimum amount, that Arba'im Se'ah, is there. I'm sure people have noticed and people will realize that often when you have a Kelim mikveh, you go, will be outside where the regular mikveh is, and it's a very, very small pool of water, which doesn't seem to contain this amount. And the way that's done is because this is through a mechanism called Hashaka. Hashaka is where you have the water which is, wherever the water comes into contact with as I said, it has to be rainwater, which came naturally, nothing artificial, something that was gathered up like that. As long as it comes into contact with the water which would be kosher for the mikveh, that would be okay. It's called hashaka. And that's essentially what's done. When you have a small mikveh, which is next to the main mikveh, they are connected together and the water's mixed, and therefore it's all connected. It's all part of that larger pool, and therefore it would suffice to have the minimum. You can see there, Aruch HaShulchan talks about this over here in source number 6. Just in bold, it says, "V'achen shesh samuch l'mikveh mayim mu'atim begumam b'fnei atzmah." So you might have maybe in a natural place, you might have a cave or something, you have a small pool of water, but it's connected to the larger area of water. That would be fine. That would be sufficient. That's just in terms of the mikveh itself. And in terms of how we do the process of Tefillat Kelim, the first thing we have to know is we have to get rid of any chatzitza. Chatzitza means something which comes and is causing an interference. And this, there's a din of chatzitza when it comes to Tefillat Kelim, and Lahavta as well when it comes to Tefillat Adam. The person is going, you have to make sure there is no chatzitza, that the object, in our case, of the kli, which is going into the water, is completely directly going into the water. There is nothing that is getting in the way. So oftentimes you'll have stickers or labels, bits of plastic, things like that are on the pot which you've bought. So those need to be removed. Just in terms of this, it's useful to understand the Gemara Nidah, source number 7 tells us, Amar Yitzchak, Dval Torah will bo makpid alav chotzitz. And that really from the Torah there's only one kind of chatzitza, which would be a problem. Some two conditions. We have rubo, i.e. it's the majority. You have something which is on the majority of the vessel. And makpidalav. Makpidalav means that you are particular about it. There's a specific substance. If it's something which is part of the pot, something that you want to be there all the time, you'd never think about removing it. That's not makpidalav. And then there would be no need to remove it. For example, sometimes you get really fancy glasses with a certain brand which have a sticker on which is never meant to be removed, telling you that these are expensive glasses of a certain make, and you would keep those on. Otherwise, that wouldn't be considered makpid. Also, rubo means that it's the majority. Now, that's the Dvar Torah. In most cases, we will be very hard-pressed to find something which is going to be rubo and makpid alav, going to fulfill these two conditions. The next stage the Gemara tells us is that chachamim ed gzera, that if it is, has just one of these conditions, there would still be considered a chatzitza mid rabbana. So even if it's something which you aren't makpid, you're not particular about it, but it is rubo, it covers the majority of the utensil, that would need to be removed nonetheless. And the more common case, something which covers only the minority of the utensil, mutor, but it's makpid alav, that you're particular about, you don't want it to be there, that would also need to be, removed. And finally, the Gemara says, what about if it's mutor she no makpid? What about any chatzitza that's there, even if it covers the minority, and you aren't particular about it? Gemara says, no, that would be a gzera l'gzera, that would be a decree to a rabbinic decree, that would be too much. But essentially, either it's the majority or it's makpid, you're particular about, that would need to be removed. And this has got nothing to do with whether this particular area comes into contact with the food or not. An important point to know. It's to do with whether the utensil comes into contact with the water. The entire utensil needs to come into contact with the water. So even if it's on the outside, you have a label, not the fancy stickers I was talking about before, but the price tag or whatever sticker which you wouldn't want to be there, that needs to be removed. And just practical advice is to, in all circumstances, to remove it at home. Usually hot water. Sometimes you take baby wipes and you can wipe it off, and you can normally get rid of it without too much trouble. This doesn't include things, rust that's on the pot or something like that. If it's just black on the pot, that's not something which is considered chotzet that you need to get rid of. That's what the Shulchan Aruch tells us. We learned something similar when we learned about Hag'alat Kelim all those months ago before Pesach, when we spoke about how to kasher Kelim, and there are a number of similarities between Hachsharat Kelim and Tfilat Kelim. They're both learned out from the same Pasuk, but many differences as well. Over there we spoke about how you need to get rid of, if there was sort of a discoloring on the kli that's not considered something which needs to be removed. But an important halacha which we did learn in terms of hagalat kelim was, we said over there, when you're kashering, let's say when you're doing hagalah, where the kli has to be kashered in boiling water. So we said it doesn't all, if it's very big and it can't all fit into the water at the same time, you could do one half and then do the other half. That's in terms of kashering, because what you're trying to do is trying to get rid of the taste, expunge the taste, which is within the utensil. Over here, when it comes to tvilat kelim, it's completely different. Tvilat kelim, the point is that we need to immerse the entire utensil at the same time. If it's too big to fit into the mikveh, we have to find a bigger mikveh. We can't, do half and then do the other half. The whole pot has to be inside at once. And so what could be slightly problematic in this regard is where you are holding it. Because if you're holding very tightly in a certain place, then that part is not going to come into contact with the water. So this is why often you have these nets or these baskets, which you'll put inside, you'll put the knives, the forks, the spoons, whatever inside this basket, you have at the mikveh, and that will go inside. And of course you have to be careful, it stays inside the basket and comes out and doesn't get lost down inside the kelim mikveh deep down. The other option is, if you have something to put it inside, you put it into the water, you let go of it or transfer it from left hand to right hand or vice versa, and then the whole thing will be in contact with the water at once. Or, it's based on the Mishnah in Mikvah, the Shulchan Aruch says, if a person were to wet their hand first in the Mikvah, and then hold the utensil, again, not too tightly, but so that the water could come through, that would also be okay. In source number 12, Sech Shea Kli Rafui Biyado B'Shat Tefillah, you shouldn't hold it too tightly. You're holding it very tightly, that's going to be considered a chatzitza between your hand and the kli, and that wouldn't work. We just said, this is just a pitchei tshuva, explains what we just said in terms of that the entire vessel needs to be in the water at once. The handles as well, as Shulchan Aruch says in source number 15, that the handles as well need to be toivled. Again, it's got nothing to do with which part comes into contact with the food or not, but it's got to do with the fact that the entire utensil as one needs to come to the water. And then finally, in terms of this section, so the bracha, there's actually three different opinions in the Rishonim as to what the bracha is that we would make on Tvilat Kelim. So here on source number 19, the Morachi, Katav al-Hashpam Diyashla Balachan ala Tvila. So there's one who says al ha-Tvila, just on immersion. There is those who say al Tvilat Kelim, on the immersion of utensils, and there are those who say al Tvilat Kelim Matachot, on the immersion of metal utensils. As we learned 2 weeks ago, it's only metal utensils which would have a chiyuv of Tvila from the Torah. Glass and other materials would certainly be midrabanan. Nonetheless, we would still say a bracha whether it's Doraita or Drabanan. The way the Shulchan Aruch paskens here on this day halacha that we would say al tvilat kelim the middle one, but there's a difference. Shulchan Aruch actually brings two different nuschaot. He says yivrech al tvilat keli or al tvilat kelim, meaning on the immersion of one utensil, and then he says al tvilat kelim. So this is one of those unique times where the bracha actually changes depending on how we're fulfilling the mitzvah. If you go to the mikvah, which is just one pot, and I think it's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach points out that the pot and its lid together are considered as one utensil. So if you go to the mikvah with just one pot or one glass, whatever it is, you would say al tvilat kli. But if you would go with more than one, you would say the bracha of al tvilat kelim in the plural. Okay, so that's more or less the process in terms of how we do tvilat kelim. Now we get on to the unique circumstances. And just before that, a bit of introduction, a bit of recap of what we spoke about last week, or 2 weeks ago. We mentioned the discussion as to whether Tvilat Kelim is Doraita or Drabanan. We saw most of the Rishonim hold that it's actually a Torah obligation to do Tvilat Kelim. The one exception possibly to that was the Rambam, because the Rambam wrote that it's Midivrei Sofrim, which seems to imply that it's Midrabanan, although there are those who understand that the Rambam is also, would hold it as Doraita. Divrei Sofrim is not exactly Drabanan, it's a different nuance. It's learned that from Psukim. Nonetheless, most of the Rishonim hold that Tvilat Kelim is Doraita. As I said, that's only when it comes to metal. When it comes to glass, it would be different. But there are two, ways of understanding the mitzvah, conceptually. We could understand there is a mitzvah to do Tvilat Kelim. And if it's a mitzvah, meaning the emphasis is on that there's a positive obligation, and if you can't do the mitzvah, if you're in a situation of ones, so then maybe there would be no mitzvah and it would fall away. The other way of looking at it, though, and many poskim understand as follows, not that it's a mitzvah necessarily, but that it's a matter, i.e., the focus is not that there is a positive obligation to toivul the kelim, rather that there is a negative prohibition to use the kli, which doesn't mean toivul, in order to circumvent, probably the wrong word, but in order to get around that prohibition, the matir would be to do the tvilat kelim. If that is our understanding, then it would be much more severe. So if you're in a situation where you have been honest, where you can't toivul the kli, so you can't toivul it, but nonetheless, there's a prohibition to use it. And if there's a prohibition to use it, then you just can't use it. And it's up into another fashion. So that distinction is going to be quite important in terms of how we understand. Also, even if we go and say that it's Doraita, however, and all the poskim we learned last week, we saw the Rama actually mentions that you cannot use a kli which hasn't been toivul. Again, if you have food which was cooked in a kli which wasn't over, the food does not become non-kosher. The food is still kosher. But you have a separate prohibition not to use the kli in the first place. That, although the Or Zarua, who's one of the Rishonim, says that it is a Torah prohibition and not to use the kli, most of the Rishonim understand that it's a rabbinic prohibition not to use the kli. So already, even if we say that Tvilat Kelim is Doraita, the fact is that not using it would be Darabanan, that already puts it down a notch, and that's going to help us. Because when we talk about some of these complex situations, we'll see a number of sfarot and a number of ideas which the poskim raise. Some of them are not as watertight as others. Maybe none of them are so, and we may not want to rely on them alone, but when we have a number of sfarot together, we can rely on them together. And certainly when we add into the mix that is, we're talking about a potential derabanan, that would make our lives a little bit easier in that regard. So let's first talk about electric appliances. It's a very, very common question. again, it's different from the fact that, you know, going back in the days of Chazal, certainly they did not have electric appliances. But the Torah tells us that klei seudah, any utensil used for food, has to go into the mikveh. All of a sudden, we fast forward a few hundred years, we have electrical appliances, which, what's the problem? The problem is that if you take a toaster, kettle, urn, you know, you name it, something electric, and you put it into water, odds are that it's not going to work again. So what do we do? So when this question first came up, there was a line of thinking, and there is a line of thinking in the poskim to say, well, maybe it may not require tefillah at all. And before we get to maybe what we might be thinking of, the first one to talk about this, I think, is the Chilkat Yaakov. You can see on footnote number 4, where the Chilkat Yaakov, who was a tremendous and posek 20th century Switzerland, really responded to many of the new questions, you know, that modernity raises, technology raises, in all sorts of areas of halakha, and he deals with this. He says that an electrical appliance, which has to be plugged in order to use it, and would not require tefillah. Interesting reason why he says it, maybe not what you might have thought. We've got the quote from Sefer Kashrut, which is a more contemporary work, but it's based on the Chilkat Yaakov. He says, "Yesh tov asavot shebalav achikni chashmani patur me'atvilah." He says, there's an opinion that says that an electrical appliance would not require tefillah at all. Mishum sheshimusho rak b'shah shemachubah l'chashmah. He says, because it's only used when it's plugged into the electricity, nechshav kemachubah l'karka. It's considered as if it is connected to the ground. What's he talking about? So when you have an appliance which can only be used when it's plugged in, the first thing you'll notice is that this fire would not apply, you know, something which works with batteries, and it wouldn't apply. But it's something which can only be used when it's plugged in to a socket. So it says if it's connected to the ground, how does that help us in any way, the fact that it's connected to the ground? Well, we discussed last time as well that there are two types of tefillah. There are two times when you would conceptually have to bring a kli to mikvah. One, the only one which applies nowadays is in terms of when it's purchased from a non-Jew, and in terms of this particular halacha of tefillat kelim. But there's another type of tefillah, maybe more basic, connected to tumah tahara, and that's what the Gemara says. And discussion in the post came as to how much exactly we can learn, extrapolate from these two types of tefillah, one to the other. But when it comes to tumah tahara, so anything which is connected to the ground, which is mechubah l'karka, is not makabel tumah, and therefore it would not require tefillah. And therefore he says, if we look at it as something which is mechubah l'karka, it's as if it's connected to the ground, it would not require tefillah, certainly not of that type, not of this type either, and therefore it would be patur. Okay, you can hear, and we'll see other poskim who would say that it sounds like a little bit of a stretch. First of all, not everybody agrees with the comparison from tefillah, from tumah tahara, to this type of tefillah. Second of all, to claim that it is mechubah l'karka is not something which everybody agrees with. At the end of the day, yes, you need to plug this utensil, this appliance in order to use it, but nonetheless, to go from there to say that it's actually connected to the ground, it's clearly not. Sheva Talevi completely rejects this out of hand. Very strong language, says, Nerlan Yotati is a hevel avod ruach. I'm quoting words from Kohelet. This is absolute nonsense. He says as well, to say that it would be exempt from tefillah is also somewhat questionable. And I don't remember if it's in this particular Shavar or another place. Shevet Alevi actually says the answer would be if you have a utensil, an appliance, which if it would undergo tefillah, it would be ruined and you wouldn't be able to use it. Well, then you just can't use it. You should just avoid buying it. That's the shita of the Shevet Halevin in at least one place. However, many other poskim don't go along with this. Rabbi Moshe Weiss has a number of tshuvot dealing with Tefillat Kelim in Chelekim of Shut Min Chasasha. And he says, and this goes back to the introduction that I gave, he's going to suggest a svara, which he's not willing to rely on in isolation. Maybe in isolation, we'll align it even more. But together with the other mitigating factors, certainly we can bring this into account. And this is what he said. And again, it's based on the introduction that I gave. If we say that tefillat kelim is a mitzvah, so to say that when you can't fulfill the mitzvah, you're exempt from it, there's room to say that. If we say it's a matir, that there's a prohibition, that's our focus, and that tefillat kelim would be necessary in order to allow it to be used, then we still have a problem. But he says over here in source number 25, Shukman Chatasha, Nira Lechora, the Kli She'ir Shal Tov Lo Beli Lashkito Patur Me'at Tvila Legama. He says it would make sense to say that a Kli, that a utensil which you could not immerse in water because it would be completely ruined, you wouldn't be able to use it again. Mutar Yishtamesh Po Beli Tvila. It would seem to make sense to say you can use it without Tvila, that there's no and there's no obligation at all. Right, that was basically what we said before, that we could say that Tevilat Kelim is actually a mitzvah rather than a matir. Or because the prohibition is only midrabanan, and you could say Rabbanan didn't make a gzera in such a case, and this would be considered anus. Continuing on to the second paragraph, he says, furthermore, the kol mitzvata tevilah in Ireland it wasn't a kli lifnei shemishtamesh bo, since the mitzvah of tevilah is to toil the kli before you use it. V'malidat tevilah ra'olam lo yechal lishtamesh bo. But if by toiling it you're not going to be able to use it, well, what's the point of that? But la la mitzvata tevilah, then the mitzvah wouldn't apply. Now all this sounds very logical, makes a lot of sense. Perhaps surprisingly, or perhaps not surprisingly, many poskim are unwilling to go along with this, or at least to this extent. And so Rav Osher says, this is a novel interpretation, because then most poskim do not write in this manner. We'll see what other approaches they have. He says, I don't want to be a dad yachid in this instance, and I don't want to rely on this alone. But certainly, as I said before, we can take this as a major consideration. And when we join it in, perhaps with some of the other factors, which, again, those ones on their own we may not rely on for various reasons, but joined together, this is something that we can rely on. I'll just say, it's not in the book, but there are other poskim who do go along with this. I've heard in the name of Rav Schecht and Rav Willig, who are very, very prominent poskim in America today, that if you have a kli that is definitely going to be damaged and destroyed by putting it in water, so then it would be exempt from tefillah. The problem is that we have certain cases, you know, certain things which maybe you could put them in water and they'd be okay. You know, there are many people who have toggled their kettles. One thing I will say is if you're going to take something electric and toggle it, the main thing to know is that you need to wait until it is completely dry before you try and use it again. You know, wait a couple of days, wait a week, however long it takes to make sure that it's completely dry. If it's wet and then you turn it on, so that will almost definitely ruin the appliance. But there may be some, a kettle or simple electric appliances, which if you toggle them, wait till they're dry, you'll be able to use them again. Nowadays, you know, things are getting more digital and things are getting more sophisticated, and it's probably less likely that it would work. But it's something that definitely will break. There's certainly room to rely on this and to say it's part of the field. Something which may or may not, that's a little bit more complicated. That is the first. That is the first approach. The second thing that we see, and the approaches that we're going to look at now are going to be particularly relevant as well to our current situation of coronavirus, social distancing. You know, can we? What do we do now that we can't take a kli to the mikvah? So the first one isn't so relevant. It's relevant to electrical appliances, but you know, in the situation we're talking about now, you have a glass, you have a pot. There's nothing intrinsic about, you know, putting the pot in a mikveh that's going to make it unfit for use. Now we have a problem of getting there, so we'll have to look at other ways. So the second approach is dismantling and having a Jew repair. So where does this come from? Again, we said, if we remember, the basis of Tfilat Kelim is that a utensil which was manufactured by a non-Jew, when the Jew purchases it, would have to undergo tefillah. If it was manufactured by a Jew in the first place, then there would be no requirement. So the Chochmat Adam, the previous century, talks about the case where we had these large industrial vats in which beer was manufactured, and they were too big to go into the mikveh. They couldn't be carried, they couldn't be transported, they couldn't be placed there. So what could be done? So the suggestion which he raises is as follows. He says, "Nirali, de'enem takana achiat bilem, there is no rectification until they're immersed." Or, and if that's not practical, what you can do, he says, shinkof by mekev gadol, you can puncture a large hole in them so that they are unfit for use. Kadeshit Patamitrati. As it's like Enoman Yisrael. So the point is they're manufactured by a non-Jew in the first place. So render them unfit for use. Make this whole. And then get a Jewish craftsman to come along and fix them. And then it's considered as if it was a Jew who manufactured this utensil. Taking that logic and moving it forward, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says do the same thing by an electrical appliance. If you can disconnect something, disassemble it in such a way that it's unfit for use and that it requires a professional to come back and fix it, then it would be the same thing. He says, sure, you disassemble it in a way that it can't be used. And you need a professional to come along and fix it. In such a case, we could render it fit for exemption. The problem with this is that it has to be done in a professional way. So this is not something that anybody can do at home. If anybody can do it at home, well, you haven't really done much. Also, you know, if we're just, you know, unscrewing the handle or unscrewing the lid or something like that, that's not rendering it unfit for use. That's the point, is you want to be the one who's creating this utensil, who's creating the kli. So if you have a Jewish electrician or somebody you can go who can really, you know, do something in a way that it's completely unfit for use and then fix it, that would suffice. But anything less than that, it is questionable whether this would really apply. The third approach, and I think this is probably the most common place one, and this is very relevant to our situation as well, is transferring ownership to a non-Jew. Last year, we discussed how this only applies, the chovah of tefillah would only apply to a utensil which is owned by a Jew, was purchased from a non-Jew, but is owned by a Jew. If it is borrowed, then there is no requirement of tefillah, even if it's borrowed indefinitely. So if the non-Jew owns it and the Jew just borrows it from him, then that would be okay. There would be no requirement for tefillah. The problem with this is that it seems like a little bit of harama. You know, it seems like a little bit of legal fiction. You know, many people, I'm sure, will have been familiar with this, you know, about mechirat chametz, you know, ask a similar question. But, you know, you go to the security guard or whoever it is, who's non-Jewish, and you say, look, I want to give you a present. I'm giving you my kettle, I'm giving you my toaster, whatever it is. I'm just going to borrow it back from you. I'll keep it in my house, you know, but it's actually yours. And is it real? Is it serious? Do we really believe in it? So this is a thing that we can question. But here is where it's significant, what we discussed before. We're looking at a situation where, according to many, there's great room to say, there's great logic to say that there's no requirement of tefillah in the first place. Again, talking about electrical appliances. Nonetheless, we don't want to rely on that. We don't want to rely on that completely because many poskim don't say it. There may still be some sort of requirement. So therefore, we say, okay, we in such a situation where we are probably exempt, but we don't want to rely on it completely. Let's join in another mitigating factor, which on its own we may not rely on either, in terms because it may be some sort of paramount. But nonetheless, by giving ownership to a non-Jew, even though we're borrowing it from him indefinitely, and the fact that, as we said in the first place, that it may break if you were to immerse it, and it may be exempt altogether. Joining those two things together, there is very strong room to say, okay, we can rely on that, and you would then be exempt from tefillah. I saw the story. I saw that of Aaron Lichtenstein, that tell it was Rosh Shiva Gush. It's not exactly connected to this point. It's not that he gave his utensils to a non-Jew, but he would rely on something else, which is hefker, which isn't in the book. But if it's not owned by anybody, in the same way, it's not owned by a Jew, and that would be allowed. Again, you might ask the same question. You know, you're going to say my utensils are hefker, but they don't actually belong to me, but they just all happen to be in my house and I happen to use them. They say that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, whenever he bought a toaster or anything electric, he would be mafkir, meaning he would consider it to be hefker. And so one Purim, you know, one of the bachrim came to his house and took his toaster. It was hefker, it didn't belong to anybody. And so after Purim, he tried to give it back, and Lichtenstein refused. He said it was hefker, it never belonged to me in the first place. It's yours, and he wouldn't actually take it back. So that's, again, if you're relying on these things, that's how serious it should be. Similar to, you know, we mentioned Mechirat Chametz, you know, every year or every few years there's a story of the non-Jew who walks into the Jewish house or the Jewish shop and asks for his chametz, and that's really a test. You know, if you turn to him like, what are you doing? Well, that's a sign you didn't really have in mind to sell it. If you say, sure, just, you know, take all my whiskey, just make sure you give me the money, that's a sign that the sale really meant something. So that's in terms of that, in terms of, and as I said, this is probably the most common practice where people, something which they're unable to toive on, this is going to be relevant now as well, would transfer ownership to a non-Jew and would borrow it to use, that would be that would be one which many people rely on, practically speaking. Approach number four, really, which is just to say what we mentioned already, there are those that say, no, you have to toive them anyway. Again, that's in terms of the type of utensil, which you know it's not going to permanently damage it. You'd wait until it gets dry, and then you could use it. There's an interesting tshuvah from Rav Moshe Feinstein, written about going back about 50 years, where he talks about a toaster. And he says, maybe there's room to be lenient as well, to say that a toaster doesn't require tefillah, because it's only klei seudah. We discussed that requires seudah, that requires tefillah, things which are used either for serving the food, preparing the food, cooking the food. And the toaster doesn't really do anything significant. Again, maybe people have thought to view toast in a different way over the past 50 years. But he says, yivush ha'pata l'idei ha'toaster. He says, it's just drying out the bread. Even those who are used to eating in such a way, it's not really critical. It doesn't really change the quality of the food, I guess. Most people just eat bread as it is, and this, so therefore this isn't considered something significant. He says, "Ein lach shivo kli l'tzorich seudah." Therefore, says Rav Moshe, you could say that a toaster is not actually considered a klei seudah. Most Poskim don't accept this, and I think the reality bears out. It's not quite the way that we view toasters. We would view it as a significant utensil. But again, this might be one of those farot which, you know, we could throw in together with all the others. There's an interesting question when it comes to storage containers and jars. You know, when you buy something in the supermarket, which is might be a drink or different sauces or things, which come in a glass jar or a glass bottle. Anything which is plastic, we mentioned last time about the materials, plastic doesn't require tefillah. Glass certainly requires tefillah, throw up a name, but it definitely requires. So you have all sorts of cans or a can as well, you might ask, because that's also metal. And when you purchase it, that is a kli that hasn't undergone tefillah. In order to use it, would it require tefillah? Would require tefillah the first time, would require tefillah after using it again. So most poskim would say that when you're using it in the first instance, it doesn't require tefillah. It's not considered really that you're using the container. But if you want to reuse it, there it becomes more of a question. Rav Shlomo Zalman Oibach in Shuv Mechad Shlomo seems to imply that if you're going to reuse it, then it would become a kli seudah, and then it would be and then you would need to toive it. So you have a glass jar of pickles or whatever it is, once the pickles are finished and you want to reuse it or for something else. And you're not just, because you're not just throwing it away, you're showing that it is something significant to you as a kli, as a utensil, therefore it might need a tefillah. Many poskim don't say that though. Many poskim would say that even these kind of glass bottles and jars, that if you want to reuse them, would not require tefillah, based on, there are a few different svarot, but we'll just mention Rav Moshe Feinstein. He says essentially that the kli, it's not really considered a kli. It's not really considered a utensil because it is subsidiary to the food. He proves this from Al-Khatir with Maaseh Sheni, which we won't go into now. But he says, "Bedvar minim shenim kalim davka makli, ein adelch lakabel akli b'chazala, k'mo cans shim b'mdinatenu." His point is, when you buy it, you buy the food together with the utensil that it's in. And he says, if you want to use them after you've emptied the food and drink, he says, I think you don't have to toy for them. The utensil, whatever it is, was subsidiary to the food. And therefore, it's only when it wasn't considered a unique utensil. When does it become a utensil? When does it become a kli, so to speak, is when you've finished that food and you now want to reuse it. You're now almost creating the kli at that point. And then it's already in your possession, and then that would be fine. The last point to talk about in terms of this, and then we'll get back to Corona, is what if we're in a situation of where somebody has a kli which we know has not undergone tefillah? As we said before, the food itself is not prohibited, but there is a prohibition, certainly midrabanan, to use a kli that hasn't been toivled. So shut your chavedad, Rav Avadia Yosef. Rav Avadia, who's koch the hetera, is well known. Rav Avadia was somebody who was very lenient where he could be and where the situation called for it. He is extremely stringent on this. He says, "Olam mitalech veitosh chavolo." He says somebody who visits his friend, biyodeh shlo tpil takelim atonim tefila, and you know that they didn't toivel the utensils. Asol alecho veleshtot bekele, right? Shet bina. It would be forbidden for you as the guest to eat and drink from those utensils. And that's quite harsh. And there are poskim who go on that route. Important to remember in terms of this, right, which are the materials that require tefillah? If it's metal, if it's glass, certainly. If it's plastic, if it's chadpa, you know, if it's disposable, things like that, which don't require tefillah in the first place, or maybe something where there's a machloket as to whether it requires tefillah or not, we could certainly rely on that lenient opinion. But the opposite can say no. Again, the idea is that the obligation for tefillah is on the person who owns the utensils. It is what we call a din on the gavra, a din on the person, not a din on the chefza, not on the utensil itself. And the proof of this, the greatest proof of this, is that if you have food which is cooked in a utensil that wasn't toivel, for whatever reason, the food itself is kosher. So it doesn't. It's not that the object becomes somewhat prohibitive. And this is Rav Yaakov Ariel in Shut Bala Shotara, and mentions this and he explains. He says, over here, just a second, which is in bold, it's that once the person is required to immerse the utensil, so as a result of that, the utensil itself needs to be toilable. But it's not that it's not like hagaret kelim where you're using a non kosher dish. And nobody's going to say that if you visit somebody where they have a pot which is being used for treif, and then they serve you food which was cooked in that pot within 24 hours, or I'm not getting into the zalach of now. But no one would say, well, it's their pot, it's their obligation to kosher, and therefore you can eat. No, food's not kosher, the food's not kosher. But over here, and because it's their obligation, he says you wouldn't be, and certainly, it's not accepted practice that a person goes into somebody else's house and says, hi, I'm just going to, pop out, take your pot to the mikveh before I come back and eat. So he says in the final paragraph, that the guest is not required to immerse the utensils in and of themselves, it is an extenuating circumstance, you can rely on this opinion, and therefore he would be permitted to use it. As I said, there are poskim who don't accept this, but certainly, if we're talking about visiting friends, we're talking about visiting family members, we're talking about a situation where shalom bayit would be affected, we're talking about extenuating circumstances like that, we can definitely rely on this opinion, to eat from the food from plates, even though they haven't been immersed in a mikveh. When it comes to a restaurant or a hotel, there's another reason maybe to be lenient in the shuvah, what the Dakei Tshuva brings. Also, you remember last time we discussed the idea that only when it's klei se'uda, only if it's utensils whose primary purpose is for the sake of the food, that would require tefillah. And Dakei Tshuva has an amazing chidush, but he says, you have a restaurateur or a hotel owner, what is his purpose in using those utensils? His purpose is making money. So they would not be considered as klei se'uda, as utensils which whose primary purpose is eating, but they would be considered klei se'chora, utensils whose primary purpose is business. And therefore, you go into a hotel and you go into a restaurant, we could argue that the plates are there used as klei se'chora, not as klei se'uda. Again, not everybody likes that se'chora. Again, there is what to question about it, but added in together with other mitigating factors, we might accept it. So let's now discuss in terms of our current situation, what can we do? Many people have asked in recent weeks, right now we can't go to the mikvahs. Most of them are closed, and some of them should be closed. Again, I'm talking about mikvahs of kelim, of utensils. I'm not talking about Tefillat Nashim. I'm not talking about women who need to go to the mikveh. That's a separate topic. But in terms of toiling the utensil, you have a new kli. You can't go to the mikveh now because it's closed. What do you do? So as we've seen, there is a requirement to take the utensil to the mikveh before we can use it. Again, first of all, what's it made of, right? If it's something which is not made of metal or glass or anything like that, it's made of plastic, it's made of earthenware or different things. If it's made of those materials which do not require tefillah, or even those materials where there's a machloket, it's whether they require tefillah or not, so we can be lenient and we can rely on that. If it's a utensil which is not necessarily considered a clay suudah, we saw last time we were discussions as to what is considered, you know, a storage jar, is that considered a clay suudah or not? So again, maybe here we might take into account those opinions that say it wouldn't require tefillah. But something which definitely does require a glass, a metal pot. What do we do? So we've seen, first of all, if we transfer ownership to a non-Jew, and that would be, that's one option that we have. We give it to somebody who's not Jewish, it becomes their utensil, we just borrow it from them indefinitely, and then we'd be able to use it. Again, there's a bit of harama going on over here, but nonetheless, we have no other option. And therefore, many Muslims have said that that is okay. There is another idea which you mentioned as well, where not transferring ownership to somebody else, but making it hefken, where you declare, preferably in front of three people, but if that's not possible, then even not in front of three people, you declare that the utensil is ownerless, that we don't, it doesn't actually belong to us, we just happen to be using it. Again, that would be something that we could rely on as well. The best would be, Rav Moshe Weiss has said, the best would be to rely on both of these together. Each one has its drawbacks, and if you, you know, rely on both, then there's more room, certainly more room for leniency. Again, I'll say all these things are shat adchak. There's no greater extenuating circumstances than this, and once we're out of this situation and the mikvot are open again and it's safe, so then those kelim should be taken. A person should keep a note of whatever new things he's bought and he has to take to the mikveh, and then he can later on go and take them and tovel them in the mikveh again. Just another word in terms of acquiring it or giving it over to a non-Jew. Now maybe it's a bit easier. You know, going back a few weeks when it was we were completely in isolation, with many people, and you couldn't come into contact with anybody. You know, how do you transfer ownership? This is something I think we discussed before Pesach, because in terms of Mechrat Chametz, when we make a kinyan, when we transfer ownership, there are different maaseh kinyan, there are different acts of transferring ownership which work halachically. The most preferable one is what's called mshicha or hagba'ah, where you lift something up. Right? When I go into a shop and I buy something, halachically speaking, when it becomes mine, it's not actually when I necessarily give the money to pay for it. It's when I lift it up or when I take it home. And that is the moment of where the halachic transfer of ownership takes place. That is always preferable. So, you know, you have your toaster, you have your urn, you have your whatever it is. How am I going back to the electrical things? You have your pot that you've just bought during that corona, and you go to your non-Jewish friend or neighbor or whoever, and you give it to them, and they take it, they lift it up, it becomes theirs. That would certainly work as a transfer of ownership. If we are nervous about too many people touching things because of spreading infection, or it's just not feasible, what do we do? So, big machloket in the poskim as to what type of maaseh kinyan would satisfy for a transaction with a non-Jew. What's probably preferable in the current situation is to use a shtar, to use a document. And if anybody's interested, I think I've sent before, I can send again. There is a link. There are batei din that are actually every day and performing this sale of kelim to non-Jewish ownership, and therefore a person can go into the link and just fill in the details on this document and sign it of what they've bought and approximately how much it costs, and then they'll know that their utensils have been sold or given over to a non-Jew. They can use them safely and comfortably and happily without taking them to the mikveh, and just to remember what it is and where it is, and when it is safe to do so, go to the mikveh again and to do the tefillah. Okay, ad kan for today. Next week we will have the second special share of Sobah Marabanan talking about coronavirus in halacha during Pesach. part one of that, which was dealing with a history of pandemics in halakha. Part two is going to be dealing with tefillah, which we spoke about tonight, but tefillah, the questions in terms of minyanim, in terms of, you know, garden minyanim and porch minyanim and things like that, if they halachically qualify. Again, right now, I'm not going into the question of whether one should or should not be doing them at the moment. This is not to sanction that, but at some point, we will have to know what that halachot are. So talk about that. Also, in terms of maybe digital, the idea of a digital minyan, if there is room for that. And also, when all else fails, if we're davening by ourselves, and maybe some changes to what can or can't be done.